This is White Collared, the podcast, season 3, episode 10, countdown. I want to thank you for joining me on this episode of White Collared, the podcast, which is a retrospective commentary on the USA Network television series White Collar. My name is Eric Alton Glenn Hilliard. Countdown first aired on August 9th, 2011. Was written by show creator Jeff Easton and directed by John Kretschmer. The FBI begins closing in on Neil and Mozzie when the agency gets a tip about a long-lost masterpiece turning up in New York, bringing the head of the DC Art Crimes Unit to join the investigation. The pair's efforts to stay one step ahead of that investigation are further threatened when Agent Melissa Matthews, who believes Neil to be Chris Gates of Interpol, joins the investigation. But the biggest threat is yet to come. The episode begins with Mozzie. He's walking through a park. He comes upon a symbol drawn in chalk on the sidewalk next to a bench with an arrow pointing toward the bench. He follows the directions, sits on the end of the bench, and then with a newspaper in his hand, taps the armrest 3 times. His phone rings. He answers and says, "The sparrow dies at midnight." Neil steps out from behind the base of a nearby statue, and it's Neil on the phone, talking into the phone, but also close enough that Mozzie can hear him in person as well. He tells Mozzie that he'd hate to be that sparrow. Well, Mozzie's not happy. He was under the impression that he was about to expose the leader of the North American Union. Basically, Mozzie was looking forward to a conspiracy. But of course, it was all a ruse by Neil because he had to talk to Mozzie somehow. Besides, the NAU doesn't even exist. Mozzie angrily calls it yet another piece of fiction by Neil, much like the yarn he spun about not having a copy of the FBI's art manifest. Neil says he understands why Mozzie's angry, and that he has a right to be, because he did lie to Mozzie about it, which Mozzie doesn't understand. Why did he lie? Neil says that after he broke into Peter's safe, he had the list in his hand and was ready to take it and go. Then he starts to say, "But when Peter called," but then he pauses as if to gather his thoughts or his courage. And after a moment, he says, "I have a life here." But still, Mozzie doesn't understand. He reminds Neil that they had a dream. And Neil, in a defensive tone of voice, says, "Well, dreams change." Then rather than simply let the statement stand as an honest expression of change of heart, he undermines the sincerity of his statement and his integrity by trying to excuse the statement as something other than a sincere change of heart, saying that they might not like whiling away their days on the Mediterranean islands, which is a shame because it exposes a lack of resolve and integrity in Neil, or at least a weakness in the strength of his resolve and integrity. He had a chance to tell Mozzie, "I've decided that despite whatever plans we've had in the past, I've reassessed and have decided that this is the right thing for me." Instead, he tries to blame his decision on circumstances, or on possibilities, or on other things. It's another one of those moments, and it's one of those instances in that moment that he could have pushed through that final barrier to the personal victory that was within his grasp, the victory of his new self over his old self, of doing what was best for himself, no matter what anyone else thinks. But he pulled back, more concerned about saving face with Mozzie than saving himself from moving away from his new life, of going back to the old life. Of course, Mozzie doesn't accept Neil's excuse, because that's exactly what it is, saying that, hey, if they don't like their island, they can sell it and come back. Neil tries to push back toward that final barrier, though not to fully commit to pushing through, but instead trying to satisfy, or at least trying to pacify both sides of a mutually exclusive equation. He sternly tells Mozzie that no, he's wrong, because even though Mozzie could come back, Neil couldn't. If he runs, he can never come back. Essentially, he's telling Mozzie the same thing that Sarah told him in Taking Account, when she said, "People like me don't get the gold-plated guitars. I don't cross any line I can't come back from." The difference being that the line Sarah wouldn't cross was the line of compromising her integrity and honesty by committing a blatantly criminal act, whereas the line Neil won't cross is choosing his new life by not committing a blatantly criminal act. But Mozzie really isn't listening to Neil. He's hearing the words, but he's not hearing the meaning. He's too obsessed by the lure, the dream, the fantasy, the obsession of that perfect last score. Seems to be more important to him than Neil's feelings. And when Mozzie tells Neil that he knew Neil was dragging his feet, an accusation leveled against Neil's desire not to lose the new life that he has, Neil counters that Mozzie went behind Neil's back and sold the Degas, even after Neil had told him not to. And it wasn't that Neil had said not to just because. He'd actually given Mozzie a very specific and solid reason why he couldn't do it. Mozzie fairly explodes and then reins in his anger. He says he sold the Degas to protect them. Neil says that selling the painting and putting a hit on Keller was rash and exactly the sort of thing that will get them into trouble, not out of it. Mozzie, not willing to admit his mistake, tries to excuse his decision by saying that Neil knows that most black market pieces never resurface. Yeah, except that most black market pieces aren't on a list of items that Peter is actively looking for, but the Degas is, and if Peter finds it, it proves that the treasure didn't burn, and the trail will lead straight back to them. So, they have to get in front of this and undo it. Neil asks Mozzie, who did he have fence the painting? Rusty. Rusty? Seriously? Obviously, Neil questions Mozzie's choice of Rusty as the fence. But regardless, he tells Mozzie, fine, we'll start there. Go talk to Rusty and find out who he sold the painting to. Mozzie's fine, in response is said with a very distinct pout. Neil gets up, begins to leave, but Mozzie calls after him, saying that there's still one question that needs to be asked. Does Neil want to stay? Neil doesn't answer the question. Instead, he says, I'll let you know. We see Neil arriving at the FBI offices, and as he enters, he sees an older man leaning against the desk, holding a small bust of Socrates. The man is Agent Philip Kramer, head of DC Art Crimes. Neil approaches, and Kramer begins speaking to Neil, holding up the bust and moving it about as if it was the living thing and as if it is doing the talking. And Kramer paraphrases Socrates by saying, the greatest way to live honorably is to be what we pretend to be. Now, for anyone who's interested, I did find numerous sources for the quote, and they vary a little bit, but from what I can find, the most accurate version of the quote is, or most complete version of the quote is, the shortest and surest way to live with honor in the world is to be in reality what we would appear to be. And if we observe, we shall find that all human virtues increase and strengthen themselves by the practice of them. Kramer then asks Neil if he knows anything about Renaissance portrait medals. He had a cold case on a Fiorentino that was taken from the Smithsonian 8 years earlier, except the one he found turned out to be chocolate, wrapped in foil. When Neil admits that it sounds vaguely familiar, Kramer tells Neil that, yeah, he thought it might. As Kramer is recounting the incident, Neil is trying hard to suppress a smile, which is a surprising lapse of self-control in an experienced con and liar. Anyway, after the two cautiously exchange names and greetings, Peter joins them and tells Neil that Kramer was his mentor at Quantico. Kramer adds that now they're just friends. Neil lightly suggests that that must mean that Kramer is the one who taught Peter everything he knows. Kramer admits that he taught Peter a fair amount, then with a sly look at Peter, adds that he kept a few things for himself. Peter jokingly responds that Kramer never told him that. When Neil asks what brings Kramer to New York, Kramer asks Peter if he's told Neil. No, he hasn't. Let's take it to the conference room. In the conference room, Peter and Kramer are holding a briefing with Neil, Jones, and Diana amongst those present. 2 days earlier, they got a tip from a CI that a black market painting, a long-lost masterpiece, surfaced in New York and has been sold. It was a Degas entitled Entrance of the Masked Dancers, which is an actual painting by Degas, but all the internet listings I found for the painting were illustrations, no historical data. So the history of the painting, the history of the actual painting, I can't account for or can't bring into line with what we're being told in these episodes, but there's nothing to disprove it either. So anyway, Peter begins to give details about the painting and then pointedly calls on Neil to give the rest of the information. Neil says that it was completed in 1884. It is considered one of Degas' seminal works, and it is more complex than the gauzy ballerinas he's famous for. Kramer picks up the story, saying that it was believed to have been taken by the Germans, along with a whole lot of other art, from the museum in St. Petersburg in 1941. Peter says it hasn't been seen since. Neil has a solemn look on his face as he listens, but then Kramer asks what Neil thinks, and he's momentarily taken aback, and then says that recovering it would be incredible. Peter agrees, then says, "We're going to find it." During the briefing, Peter keeps looking at Neil, and from the look on his face, not only is it clear that he's watching Neil's reactions very closely, it seems it also is meant to send an unspoken message to Neil, which is, as Peter says at the end of the briefing, "We're going to find it." And Neil looks uncomfortable. Yeah, definitely uncomfortable. At Neil's apartment, he returns to conduct a briefing of his own with Mozzie. Mozzie has left word for Rusty, but that's the best he can do because Rusty's taken off for the Poconos. But Mozzie doesn't seem overly concerned until Neil tells him that the FBI knows about the painting, and at the very least, they have to get a hold of Rusty and make sure that he keeps their name out of it. Oh, and Kramer from the DC Art Crimes? Yeah, he's here to help Peter. When Mozzie asks what Kramer's like, Neil describes him by telling Mozzie to imagine Peter, add years of experience, and subtract any inclination to cut them slack. Then, of course, there's the fact that Kramer apparently has an encyclopedic knowledge of the Impressionists. But on the upside, if it can be considered that, Agent Melissa Matthews is not with Kramer. Mozzie muses that had she been, it would be a tough situation for Neil. Neil directs Mozzie to stop concerning himself with the problem that isn't and focus on the problem that is. They have to locate the Degas and get it back in order to keep Peter from finding it. During the conversation, a giant hourglass has been sitting on the table and just at the edge of Neil's vision, and it finally gets to him. He demands to know, "Why is there a giant hourglass on my table?"
"Somewhere along the line, I think your motives got blurred. 48 hours. In that time, I will do anything you think we need to do in order to leave."
"And when time runs out?"
"Lolana and I are taking the treasure and leaving, regardless of the list, the Degas, or the FBI. I hope you'll come with us."
"You're giving me an ultimatum."
"Yes, I am. Stay here with Peter or come with me. Choose a side, Neil."
Well, I've said it before, ultimatums rarely work out. It's one thing to describe a situation and show that it demands a choice one way or the other because the situation demands the choice, but it's different to say that you have to make a choice because I demand it. It moves the choice from being impersonal, this or that, because of the circumstances, and makes it personal because the person giving the ultimatum is making it about themselves and essentially making it a test of the relationship. Now, to be fair, Neil just got back what he did to Mozzie in the last episode. So it's not like Mozzie's doing it and Neil's never done it to him. They're both setting up ultimatums for each other. And yeah, if one ultimatum is bad, then two of them is even worse. At the Burke home, Elizabeth and Peter are playing host to Kramer. They're looking at photos of Peter and Neil and swapping war stories, so to speak, and laughing over them, prompting Kramer to ask what happened to the stoic, no-nonsense probie that they used to call the archaeologist. When Elizabeth inquires about the name, Kramer explains that it was bestowed upon Peter because he had never stopped digging. Peter defends himself as still being stoic, but Elizabeth disagrees, saying that Neil has loosened him up a bit, but in a good way. Kramer asks about the photo in hand, commenting that it looks like it was taken right there in the Burke kitchen. But it's not just a casual comment. He's leading up to something.
"Neil's my CI, and he's
also a friend. Before I met you, I had a CI who used to throw batting practice for my son's little league team. Now I get the occasional email from prison. These are short-term relationships, Petey, at best. It's hardwired in their brains."
"You think once a con, always a con?"
"I think recidivism rates paint a bleak picture. You have to protect yourself when they fall.
I know my career's at risk.
No, I'm not talking about your job. I'm talking about you. When this happens, you're not slapping cuffs on a criminal. You're taking down a friend. It hurts.
People can change.
Pete, you asked me for my help. If Neil is a suspect,
he is.
Then you have to treat him like one.
This is a tough conversation, not just for Peter, but for Kramer too. He's having to tell a friend some hard facts. It may seem that Kramer is giving an unnecessarily pessimistic and maybe intentionally hurtful view of the situation. After all, it seems unfair to assume that once a con, always a con, or as Kramer puts it, that some people are hardwired for crime. It's easy, and perhaps in some ways, some perverse ways, comforting, to dismiss it all as an unfair stereotype, but the facts do seem to support Kramer's dismal view. According to a 2021 report from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, a 2008 to 2018 study of recidivism rates among prisoners released in 2008, about 66% of the prisoners that were released in 2008 were rearrested within 3 years, and 82% were rearrested within 10 years. Now, being arrested is not necessarily a solid indicator of recidivism because people can be and are often arrested for things and the case is later dropped, either because further investigation clears them of the crime for which they were initially arrested or because the prosecutor chooses to drop the case for any one of a variety of reasons. But what is telling is that the study showed about 61% of the prisoners released in 2008 returned to prison within 10 years. Granted, 61% of convicts returning to prison means that 39% don't return to prison. But that is still not a statistic which is encouraging. But the issue of recidivism is not being brought up here simply as a discussion of statistical possibilities. It's about Peter being blind to the fact that a friendship with a convict is a risk. And what's interesting is that Kramer doesn't take the tack that most bosses would take, which would be to make it about Peter's job and career. And when Peter assumes that that's what Kramer's talking about, Kramer is adamant that he's not talking about that. He's talking about Peter and the emotional impact having to arrest a friend can have on a person. And it's not just the sense of betrayal that the officer must feel because of what the friend did that results in his being arrested, but also the sense of betrayal that the officer must feel because of what they're having to do to their friend. And given the story that he's told about his own CI, he's clearly speaking from personal experience. Yes, the conversation is meant to be hard and even hurtful in a sense, but not out of a sense of cruelty, but out of a sense of compassion, in the same way that surgery can be painful, but necessary to avoid a greater pain later. Now, when we first met Kramer, it was easy to take an immediate dislike to him and view him as being a cold, hard individual, because that is the vibe he gave out back in the bullpen, and actually gives out through much of the episode. But I think it's misleading. I think he's a bit like Peter, a good-hearted person who has learned to wear a protective armor of uncompromising toughness out of a sense of self-preservation. Next, Peter and Kramer have Neil in the office's interrogation room, and they are conducting something of a backhanded interrogation, although they portray it as them needing his expertise.
Let's say that you're in possession of a masterpiece that disappeared 70 years ago.
Like a Degas?
Exactly.
You can imagine that, right, Neil?
Enjoying the fantasy as we speak, sir.
Too bad it can't last. Why not? Because the painting's hot. You have to get rid of it.
Or the feds will take me down?
Exactly.
So I've got a hot day guy I need to move before you take me down.
Question is, how do you fence it?
I don't. I'd have someone fence it for me.
Why go through a middleman?
A day guy appearing after all this time is going to be greeted with a healthy amount of skepticism.
Well, people will assume it's a forgery.
Yeah, they usually are. So I'd need someone with an impeccable reputation to make the sale. You want me to ask around?
Actually, Kramer's team already has two suspects in mind.
This is Gus Leland. Deals exclusively in French Impressionists. Recently returned to New York.
Yeah, I know Gus. He always has quality work. He definitely fits the bill.
Second guy is known as Rusty. Renowned for an impeccable eye at spotting forgeries.
he's suspected of brokering the black market sale of Matisse's La Pastorale last year.
Yeah. It's also rumored he recently sold a high-priority painting here.
Tell me, Neil, when you fence your digger, who are you going to use?
Rusty's got the local contacts. I go with Rusty.
Then that's who we'll go after.
The entire conversation is presented as a sort of a hybrid between the hypothetical and the real. They start at the beginning with, let's say you do this, the hypothetical. But then partway through, the language changes to the non-hypothetical. You have to. You are going to. What do you do? Now, it could be argued that the context is still hypothetical. And hypothetically, it is. But the choice to change the language is a deliberate choice and intended to not only create a sense of they know in Neil's mind, but also send the message, we know. Neil's choice of giving them Rusty as the fence is one of those best bad choice situations. He really didn't have an option but to select one of the two names, knowing that it would be suspicious if he tried to point elsewhere. And by giving Rusty's name, at least he had the possibility that Peter would follow that lead, leaving the other to Kramer, and that he would be able to at least keep tabs on Peter and what was happening in the investigation of Rusty. After Kramer leaves to get his team going on Gus Leland, Neil suggests that he call Mozzie for Peter, with the excuse that Mozzie keeps tabs on Gotham's black market elite and can tell them where Rusty might be. But Peter says, no, not necessary. They've been keeping an eye on Rusty for the last 24 hours, and they know exactly where he is. Which is a problem, because during the interrogation, Mozzie had sent Neil a text that he's on his way to meet Rusty. As Peter and Neil head out to pursue Rusty, down on the street, Neil seems to be in a hurry. And he's been keeping his phone in his hand, likely to be able to quickly send Mozzie a text to warn him off should the opportunity present itself. But Peter, wanting to keep Neil on a short leash, insists that rather than take the car, they should walk. And what's the deal with keeping the phone in his hand? Neil makes an excuse, but Peter tells him, put it away. They're going to talk. Neil says, okay, let's talk. You first. Tell me why Kramer's really here. He's a friend and a mentor. No, he's a watchdog. Peter asks if that's what Neil really thinks a mentor is. Neil references Homer's description of a mentor as half god, half man in the Odyssey, but Peter points out that mentor represented the union of path and goal and was wisdom personified. Neil continues, saying that mentor also guided Odysseus' son during the Trojan War. Then he asks Peter if he's planning to go to war. Peter says, no, not planning to, yet. But if he does, Kramer's got his back. Neil casually says that it must be nice having someone who believes in you. And Peter responds that he never gave Kramer a reason not to. Neil doesn't seem to quite get it. Since he and Mozzie began conspiring about the treasure, Neil seems to be trying to convince Peter to trust him, that he's deserving of Peter's trust, which is sort of his intention here with this comment about it being nice to have someone who believes in you. And he's been hurt and angry at Peter's obvious lack of trust in him. And yet, here he is, right in the middle of giving Peter a reason not to believe him, and seemingly not making the connection between his actions and the result of those actions. Next, we're in the park. We see Rusty, a man with a bright red hair, walking through the park toward a meeting with Mozzie. After the two exchange a few put-downs, Mozzie gets to the point. In something of a panic, he says that he wants to know who Rusty sold the painting to because Mozzie needs it back. Rusty says he can talk to the guy who might be willing to sell it back to Mozzie for a tidy profit. Mozzie's insistent, and Rusty's annoyed. At first, he thought Mozzie was merely questioning his professional discretion. Now it seems that Mozzie's trying to cut him out of future deals by going straight to the buyer himself. And he's not dumb enough to do that because his entire job is dependent on people like Mozzie not knowing that sort of information. Mozzie's tone moves from one of panic to one of intense seriousness. The FBI is looking for the painting, but Rusty's not buying. He thinks Mozzie's trying to scare him into giving up the information, calling it sad. Mozzie insists that it's not sad, it's urgent. The feds are here. And as he's saying this, he grabs Rusty, perhaps as if trying to look over Rusty's shoulder, an impossible and absurdly unbelievable task since Rusty's nearly a foot taller than Mozzie. But for whatever reason, he does it, it's really just a distraction so he can lift Rusty's cell phone. Then he runs off as Peter and Neil approach from the background. And of course, Rusty still thinks Mozzie's trying to pull a fast one. He hollers after Mozzie that he can't believe that Mozzie would really go with the old tired G-Man or after me bet. Except that as he turns around and sees Peter and Neil, and Peter pulls out his badge, yelling at Rusty to stay where he's at, he realizes that, oops, it really is the feds. Peter calls Diana to get the backup moving in, but in the meantime, Neil suggests that he and Peter split up in order to try to trap Rusty. Peter hesitates, not wanting to let Neil out of his sight, but there really isn't any other option at the moment. Not if they want to have a chance to catch Rusty. So they split up, and as they're pursuing Rusty, Neil and Mozzie meet, and the first thing Mozzie wants to know is, why did Neil bring Peter? Neil says that the FBI has been watching Rusty and that this was his first chance to warn Mozzie because Peter hasn't let him out of his sight. Mozzie tells Neil that he didn't get any information out of Rusty, which isn't good, but on the other hand, Rusty probably won't tell the FBI anything either, which is good. Neil tells Mozzie that he's got to head off Rusty before he gets away. Mozzie doesn't like the idea, but Neil tells Mozzie that Peter's gunning for him, and if he helps catch Rusty, maybe Peter will give him a bit of breathing room. Well, like I said, Mozzie's not happy about the situation, but he gives Neil Rusty's cell phone, informing him that all the references to Neil and Mozzie have been deleted from it. The pursuit continues, and we see shots of Peter, Neil, and Rusty all running until Rusty comes upon Neil, who's blocking the exit. Peter runs up from behind and suggests that they need to have a talk about a man and a Degas. Neil smiles at Peter and comments on the value of good old-fashioned teamwork. Peter responds with a half-smile. As the agents are putting Rusty in the car, he looks over to Neil, who gives a very slight shake of his head. Nearby, Peter is telling Kramer that the first thing Rusty said was that he wanted his lawyer. Kramer comments that Rusty knows that talking won't do anything good for his reputation and that they need some sort of leverage. Holding up Rusty's cell phone, Neil says they've got it, suggesting that he found it after Rusty had tossed it and that the recent call list should probably help them figure out where he got the Degas. Peter tells Neil that they'll give the phone to the ERT folks to see what they can get out of it, and then tells Neil that they'll meet up in the office to go over the details. After Neil's left, Kramer muses that Neil seems awfully helpful, considering he's their lead suspect, and Peter agrees that it does seem that way. Later, back at the FBI, Neil is in the elevator to go up to the white-collar offices, and who should come running up to catch the elevator but Agent Matthews, who recognizes Neil as Interpol Agent Chris Gates, the name he gave when they had previously met while he was plying her for information, and who had revealed the existence of the manifest to Neil. After a bit of small talk, Matthews indicates surprise that Interpol has been brought in and asks Neil if he's on his way up to see Peter. Well, Neil has no choice but to agree that he is, to which Matthews says, great, we'll go up together. And Neil responds with a frustrated, fantastic. As they're going up, Neil asks if she's there about the Degas. She sidesteps, saying that she only knows what Kramer tells her. After a long silence, Neil turns to her and begins baiting her by asking if he can trust her. She asks, what's wrong? With a tone of voice that suggests that she isn't certain what he's talking about. He asks again, in a conspiratorial tone. She responds, try me. Neil starts to say something, then stops, as if thinking better of it, then dismisses the subject by saying, no, you're not authorized. Authorized for what? It seems that she's starting to nibble at the bait. So Neil, in full on, I'm a secret agent, and I'm on a secret mission, and I need your help mode, tells her that there's a mole in the white-collar division. They intercepted an unidentified transmission, and someone in the New York office is trying to make a play for the sub's stolen art. He's there on special assignment. No one in the New York office can be trusted, and as far as anyone's concerned, he's a recovery consultant on loan to the Bureau. He apologizes for being careless and letting his cover slip on that night at the bar and for getting her involved in it. And to call him Neil, not Chris. Then he adds, he definitely didn't regret the drinks with her. From the look on her face throughout the story, Matthews clearly shows signs that she's finding the story somewhat incredible, and not in the good kind of incredible. By the end of it, it seems apparent that she's not sure what Neil's up to and why he's telling her this fantastic yarn, and that she really doesn't quite believe it. And maybe she thinks he's a bit nuts, but at the same time, she seems confused as to why he would tell such an unbelievable story. So despite her apparent lack of competence, as demonstrated by the previously referenced bar scene, she at least has enough sense about her to question Neil's story and behavior. Anyway, as they get up to the office level and they walk off the elevator, they're met by Peter. More small talk ensues, and among other things, Matthews comments that she and Neil had a very interesting conversation on the ride up. Peter, with a slightly mocking tone, comments that Neil is always good for that, and he tells them that the phone numbers on Rusty's phone has given them some leads. In the conference room, Peter and Kramer are holding another briefing. They report that it looks like Rusty deleted several numbers from his phone before Neil found it, so they don't know who he bought the Degas from, but they think they know who bought it. Elliot Richmond, who made a fortune selling black market arms. They inform the team that many black market dealers have stopped trading in cash because it's too easy to trace, too unwieldy, and it's easier for them to just simply trade a single piece of art worth millions. Plus, Richmond seems to have a personal taste for the Impressionists. Peter looks at Neil and prompts him for more details about the process of using art as currency, since he's had some experience in this sort of payment process. Neil starts out by saying that the details are sensitive and references a thief who traded art for a batch of stolen identities. Then, for the benefit of Agent Matthews, he comments that it was a tough assignment. It's an odd term to use, and Peter catches it and has a questioning look on his face. Neil tries to cover it by saying that, yeah, the Wesley Godfrey cover was blown, and quickly asks, what is going to be their angle on Richmond? Peter and Kramer continue, saying that Richmond's only property in the city is a penthouse, and since he loves to have his art nearby to look at, it's a good bet that he's keeping the Degas in the penthouse. Kramer says they've already set up a buy with him, and then he calls on Melissa Matthews. Matthews, who's been visibly restless after Neil's comment about the assignment, reaches down, picks up a briefcase she's had with her and has brought with her from the DC offices, then sits on the briefing room table and opens it. Diana immediately starts drooling, metaphorically at least. In the briefcase is a Heckler & Koch MP5K that she says is designed to shoot through a briefcase, and Kramer says that he recovered it while working on a case in Germany several years previous. And lest anyone think that this is an invention of the writers, it is not. It was an actual clandestine weapon system designed for VIP protection operations. Are they rare, as they indicate here? Well, yes. Fairly rare. Were civilians unable to get their hands on them? Maybe, maybe not. The briefcase appears to have been generally available for sale for a few years, although the laws in many countries may have severely restricted the ability of ordinary citizens to purchase the case without special authorizations being granted. And it doesn't seem that a huge number of the cases were manufactured. So in that sense, the cases do seem rare. But the weapon itself is not exceedingly rare and doesn't actually appear to have been modified as part of a system, as Diana seems to suggest. Although that may be mistakenly believed to be the case here, as there were apparently several variants of the MP5K which would not have been compatible with the briefcase without some modification. And since the MP5K is a fully automatic weapon, legal ownership by civilians might not be an option throughout much of the world and would be very difficult in the U.S., though not impossible. So what Diana says about the weapon system, the briefcase, the gun, is kind of true from a certain perspective, but not really in the sense that most people would interpret it as being. At any rate, as part of the fake buy the FBI has set up with Richmond, they've suggested that they can get him a couple hundred, which should be worth enough to allow them to negotiate for the Degas. Peter will pose as the seller, with Diana as his backup. Neil questions this, but Peter points out that Neil hates guns, whereas Diana, she loves them. But good news, sort of. Neil isn't completely setting this one out. He'll be in the van with Kramer, who gives Neil a slightly malicious grin as he says it. Next, we see Peter and Diana in the penthouse of Mr. Richmond. Richmond is very interested in the weapons system, asking how many Peter can get. Peter says, too gross. Which is actually 288, not 200. But adds that the deal will be costly because they are rare items. Richmond says, oh yeah, he understands that, but what he doesn't understand is what Diana, who apparently has been quiet up to this point, is doing there. Peter simply says that she's there to assist him. Richmond sarcastically asks if she can talk for herself. Diana does, and Snidely tells him that What she is Peter's muscle, which Richmond seems to find amusing. Out in the van, Kramer and Neil are listening in. Kramer calls Diana impressive. Neil chips in that she's almost as impressive as Peter. Kramer tells Neil that one thing you can be sure about with Peter is that he accomplishes what he puts his mind to. If he's got a target, he'll keep pursuing it till he hits it. Dead center. It's clearly a pointed statement, but it isn't said in a threatening or aggressive tone. It's said with a quiet, calm intensity, and in a way that would be taken as a simple statement of fact to someone innocently overhearing, but taken as an assurance of the inevitable to someone who knows that they are the target. Back inside, Richmond tells Peter that if he can get a gross of the items, they've got a deal. Peter says to consider it a done deal, except for, you know, the part where he doesn't do cash or check. Richmond assures Peter that he doesn't do it either, and then goes on to say that he's recently acquired a very valuable item, financially speaking, and it's worthy of the guns. But before Neil and Kramer can hear what the item is, Peter casually presses a button on his watch, breaking the audio connection to the van. In the van, Neil asks, what happened? Kramer tells him, well, maybe Peter doesn't consider Neil as much a partner as he thinks he is. Well, with the deal made, the team is back in the office. As Peter and Kramer confer upstairs in Peter's office, Melissa Matthews and Neil are in the bullpen. They exchange comments about being out of the loop, after which Kramer calls Matthew to join him in the conference room, and Neil heads to join Peter in his office. Neil asks, what happened? Your watch cut out. Peter excuses it as an equipment malfunction. It happens, you know that better than anyone. But Peter can't seem to resist the urge to say it with a bit of a smirk on his face and in his voice. Equipment malfunction? Yeah, right. And what Neil knows is that it's usually not an equipment malfunction. It's usually a deliberate act. So maybe giving a little too much information there, Peter. Revealing too many cards. And I say that because Neil gets it, and he isn't happy. Peter's not going to tell him everything. Peter says he's just following his leads, and if Neil doesn't like where they go, too bad. Neil basically accuses Peter of being Kramer's puppet, saying that that's Kramer talking, and that Kramer is the devil on Peter's shoulder. Peter's response is hard. No, he's reminding me why I'm here. Neil's anger begins to show, and he indignantly responds, I'm helping this investigation. Peter responds with a cold intensity. Do you remember what you said to me the first day I accused you of stealing the art? Neil responds with a sideways look of annoyance, but he doesn't answer. Peter bores in. What was it, Neil? With a guilty resignation in his voice, Neil responds with the words from that day. Prove it. As Peter says, be careful what you wish for. Not only did Neil challenge Peter when he told Peter to prove his suspicions, essentially he confirmed them, at least in Peter's mind, when he said it. And it was a really dumb move on Neil's part. It's one thing to challenge somebody to try and prove something that's unprovable because it's not true. But it's another thing to challenge them to prove something when it is true, especially when you want to hide that fact from them. It's a case of Neil letting his emotions get the better of him and not thinking about the long-term consequences of his actions before he takes them. Anyway, from Peter's office, Neil spots Matthews walking through the bullpen below, headed out of the office with a folder that has red markings stamped across the front of it. Now, Neil probably can't read it from that distance, but anything that Matthews has with large red stamps across the front of it would probably be considered important in Neil's mind. He excuses himself and leaves Peter and follows Matthews out of the bullpen and into the hallway. He sneaks up behind her and grabs a piece of paper which is conveniently poking out from the folder. It's a request for a warrant to search Richmond's penthouse at 1 o'clock the following afternoon. After quickly scanning the document, Neil places it face down on the floor, backs away, and then begins jogging toward Matthews as if he's just come up upon her. He calls out to her saying, hey, you dropped something, and as he approaches the paper, as if to pick it up, Matthews rushes up from the opposite direction and urgently waves him off with the words, I'll get it. And it's obvious that she doesn't want Neil to see the paper. Next, we see Mozzie is visiting a street vendor of clothing that a tourist might wear when visiting a tropical island. Standing in front of a mirror, he's holding up various shirts in front of himself, imagining himself wearing them. He's also having an imaginary conversation with an imaginary female on that imaginary island that he's just bought with that imaginary money that he imagines he's going to get from the sale of the treasure. Yeah, he's definitely counting his chickens before they've been hatched. But his fantasy is interrupted by a phone call from Neil. They have a problem. Neil tells him about the search warrant that Peter has submitted the request for. So they need to meet at Neil's apartment that night to formulate a plan. After he hangs up from the call, Mozzie goes back to admiring himself with the shirts in the mirror. But as he does, he sees Keller's reflection in the mirror as well. Keller's using a long, intimidating knife to eat a mango. Mozzie, seemingly concerned that Keller might have other uses for the knife in mind, tells Keller that he should know that Mozzie always has an escape route scoped out. Five paces to his left is the A-train. To his right is Jerry, a noble hot dog vendor who would gladly risk his life for Mozzie's. But Keller's no dummy. Referencing the shirts, he suggests that there's only one exit Mozzie's concerned with. He also reveals that he knows it was Mozzie who put the contract out on him. Mozzie tries to use Keller's knowledge against him, saying that all Mozzie has to do is scream and all of New York comes down on Keller. But Keller isn't fazed, replying that if Mozzie screams, Keller will use his already handy knife, gut Mozzie like a carp, then hop the A-train, five paces to Mozzie's left. Mozzie tries to blunt Keller's threat by suggesting that the noble hot dog vendor would never let Keller get that far. Presumably that far means Keller getting onto the A-train. Of course, even if that were the case, there's still the part where Mozzie's been gutted like a carp, so his response to Keller really isn't all that meaningful. But Keller, despite being the target of Mozzie's contract, admires Mozzie's chutzpah, telling him that he makes the kind of ruthless choices that Neil would never make. And impatiently, Mozzie asks Keller what he wants. Keller says that Mozzie knows what he wants, and that he's only there as a courtesy. The courtesy is that Keller is giving Mozzie one more chance, his last chance, to cut Keller in on the treasure. And Mozzie, intent on playing dumb right to the end, says he doesn't know what Keller's talking about, and even if he did, the answer would still be no, you know, on general principles. Keller says, fine, since you won't cut me in, even after I ask nice, I'm going to have to make you cut me in. Mozzie, apparently not fully believing what Keller could do to make them cut him in, asks how he plans to do that. But Keller's response is, why spoil the surprise? At the Burke home, Peter is at the dining table, staring at the computer.
You think that thing had sports scores on it?
I'm looking at Neil's tracking data.
Is that what you've been doing for the last hour?
I need to know where he is.
Oh, honey, it's almost 10 o'clock on a Monday. I don't think he's going anywhere.
Yeah, I can't be too sure, not now. All goes well, we'll recover the painting tomorrow.
Then what?
Then I'll know the truth.
Neil really did it, didn't he?
What's got you suddenly so convinced?
You? The last time you obsessed this much, you caught him.
We know that Elizabeth is fond of Neil, and she seems to always want to believe the best about him. Yet here she is, accepting that Neil has done something wrong. Two things about this. First, she believes in Peter. She trusts Peter. She knows him and his behaviors. She knows that he doesn't get to this point, no doubts about someone's guilt and obsessive, unless he knows. He may not have the evidence to prove it, but he knows. The other thing is that, as a good parent, and again, I've commented that Peter and Elizabeth seem to think of Neil as their surrogate child. As a good parent, you can believe in your child's guilt, and you can acknowledge your child's guilt, and you can recognize the need for your child to be held responsible for their decisions and their actions while simultaneously believing in your child and supporting them and loving them. And in fact, that is really the essence of loving them. And that is what Elizabeth is doing here. She's not making excuses for him. She's not trying to justify or ignore what he did. She's acknowledging it, and yet that doesn't change her feelings about Neil. Back at Neil's apartment, Neil is working on a fake Degas when Mozzie arrives, knocking on the door in iambic pentameter. He immediately tells Neil that Keller is back and wants their treasure. Neil is astonished that Keller would return to New York, considering every law enforcement agency in the country is looking for him, along with half the criminal underworld. Mozzie insists that this means that Keller's planning something big and that they absolutely have to get out before Keller makes his move. But Neil rejects Mozzie's demand, saying, no, we deal with the Degas problem first, then we deal with Keller. He's not going to let Mozzie turn the 48-hour ultimatum into a right-now ultimatum. He's nearly done with the forgery, and he has a plan. They'll have a 10-minute window during the FBI raid to swap the painting. And right away, Mozzie's pessimistic, saying that, oh, he thought Neil had a good plan. Neil responds that with Peter on his back, they don't have a lot of flexibility or options. Before Neil continues, Mozzie grabs a bottle of wine to pour himself a drink. Apparently, he's going to need it to get to the point where he'll buy into the plan. He grabs a stemless wine glass, then hesitates, puts the wine glass back down, then grabs a much larger tumbler and fills the glass about a quarter of the way up. He hesitates again, looks at Neil, and begins pouring more wine into the glass, nearly filling it. Apparently, he figures he's going to need a lot of wine to get to the point where he'll buy into the plan. Neil explains that Richmond's penthouse is on the 43rd floor, accessed by two elevators and the fire stairs. And then we cut to the FBI briefing room where Peter and Kramer is giving Diana and Jones a parallel briefing on their plans. Richmond thinks that they're there to deal, but they have to tread carefully. Richmond's got a personal arsenal, so they have to take him down quickly so he doesn't have a chance to grab a weapon. Diana and Peter will go up in one of the elevators. Jones and his team will ascend to the 43rd floor via the stairs. Good thing he does cardio. Neil will be with Peter so that Peter can keep tabs on him. Back at Neil's apartment, Neil continues outlining his plan to Mozzie. Peter's plan will be to take Neil to the penthouse, but Neil is going to make sure that Peter locks him up into the holding room that's next to the guard's desk before he goes up to Richmond's. Padded shoes will give Neil the ability to sneak over to the elevator, which is a short distance away, and Mozzie's elevator override box will delay things enough to give Neil time to hit Richmond's apartment before Peter gets there. Mozzie sees a flaw in the plan. The FBI will be on the stairs and in the elevator. There's no other way down. Neil gives Mozzie a slight grin, saying, I know. Back at the FBI, Kramer is questioning Peter's plan. He doesn't understand why Peter is planning to keep Neil so close when he goes for the Degas. Peter says he wants to see Neil's expression when he has the painting in his hands. And no, there's not much of a chance Neil will try anything tonight, and even if he does, Peter's got a team monitoring his anklet location. Kramer counters that none of that means that Neil isn't up to something. Peter smiles and says yes, he's sure Neil is up to something. Back at the apartment, Mozzie asks Neil about one last problem with the plan. How are they going to get the forged Degas and everything else Neil needs up to Richmond's penthouse in the first place? Neil says Mozzie's going to do it, but he's going to need a bazooka. Next, we see that Mozzie is with Richmond in his penthouse. He's showing Richmond the bazooka, specifically an AT-4 recoilless rifle. The AT-4 is one of the most common light anti-tank weapons in the world, with over 600,000 of them manufactured since it first went into operation with the U.S. Army in 1987. It's designed to give infantry units a means to destroy or disable armored fighting vehicles and fortifications, and as an assault weapon effective against buildings and fortifications. It's generally ineffective against more modern main battle tanks, especially those with reactive armor. Richmond is interested, asks how many Mozzie can get, and where did they come from? 200. And let's say they fell off a truck. How does Richmond know that they weren't damaged falling off the truck? Keep this one as a floor model. Take it. Test it out. See if you like it. After Mozzie leaves Richmond, he heads to a nearby utility room. He opens an access panel full of electrical connections, connects a laptop computer, and then after a few keystrokes, calls Neil via an earpiece communication set, telling Neil that he has full control over the elevators. Downstairs, Peter and the team, along with Neil, are entering the building. Peter catches sight of a lockpick set in Neil's jacket, pulls it out, and asks what he's planning to do with it. Neil somewhat flippantly replies, always be prepared, right? Not what Peter wanted to hear. Peter pockets the lockpick set, grabs Neil by the arm, and leads him to the security desk while Diana makes her way to the elevator. At the desk, Peter tells the security people that Neil is a hostile witness and asks if they have somewhere he can be locked up while Peter is upstairs conducting his business. Security guard takes them to a holding room, and Neil makes a show of protest about being locked up. After Peter locks Neil in the room, he returns to the security desk and tells the guards, under no circumstances is he to leave that room. He has no medical condition. He's had enough water. He's been to the bathroom. If he calls you, don't answer. If he requests anything, don't acquiesce. I'm the only person to open that door. Sounds like he's talking about a dog. Anyway, convinced that Neil won't be going anywhere, Peter and Diana head up to Richmond's apartment. In the holding room, once Neil is sure that Peter has gone, he puts his earbud back into his ear and then calls Mozzie. Mozzie, with the display from the elevator monitor cameras on his computer, sees Peter and Diana headed up to Richmond's apartment, then halts the elevator between floors, trapping Peter and Diana. Diana alerts Jones to stand by, then calls down to the security desk to inform them of the situation and instructs them to get the elevator moving. Now! In the meantime, Mozzie is also watching the guards at the security desk via the cameras connected to his computer. At an opportune time, when the guards have turned away and the door to the side room is out of their sight, Mozzie gives Neil the go, and Neil, using lockpick tools that he had hidden in his hat, picks the lock on the door, exits the room, and slips unseen past the security desk and the distracted guard. At the same time, Mozzie uses the computer to open the elevator door so that Neil can enter the elevator without having to wait for the door to open. While Diana continues to cajole the security guard, who insists that he has to reboot the elevator control computer, which takes time, the elevator with Neil as a passenger has made its way up to the 43rd floor. Once there, he slips into Richmond's apartment and, looking around, quickly spots the likely hiding place of the painting. It's hidden behind another painting, which is hanging on the wall. Neil removes the Degas from its hiding place, moves to the bazooka, removes the forgery, which has been rolled up and hidden inside the firing tube of the bazooka. But time is running short. The elevators have been reset. Peter and Diana are on their way up, and Mozzie keeps urging Neil to hurry up. Neil quickly, but patiently, places the forgery into the hiding place of the original and places the original in an art tube that he has. Having completed his task, he double checks, makes sure that everything is as it should be, and then as Peter and Diana are ringing the doorbell to the apartment, he slips out of the apartment and onto the balcony. He pauses for a moment, looks back into the apartment, and he can see Richmond opening the front door for Peter and Diana. Peter and Diana give Richmond some bad news. There are no guns. They've got a warrant to search his place, and he's under arrest for illegal arms trafficking. Mozzie gives Neil an update. Then he exits the utility room. Neil has strapped a parachute pack onto his back and secured the art tube with the painting to his back as well. And in a sequence you might not want to watch if you have issues with vertigo, and I'm quite serious about that, he climbs over the security rail of the balcony, tosses his hat down toward the street, and then jumps. He quickly falls through the sky, finally pulling the ripcord, opening the chute, and then lands on the street below. On the street, he abandons the parachute and harness assembly, hands off the art tube to Mozzie as the two cross paths, spots his hat, and returns it to his head. Next, we see Peter opening the door to the security room where he left Neil, and as he opens it, Neil is sitting there with an impatient attitude. Peter holds up the painting he's recovered, and Neil dutifully plays the part of the surprised innocent, saying, "You found it." But Peter reminds him that Kramer has to confirm it. And as they walk away from the room, we see that one of the panels of the suspended ceiling is askew. At the FBI offices, Kramer is examining the painting under magnification. He states that the piece is consistent with the period where Degas moved from dark palettes to bold colors, the strokes angle slightly to the right, and the signature is dead on. Neil chips in that Degas was losing its sight toward the end, and this painting has a crispness. He doesn't get to finish. Peter cuts him off, ordering him to stay out of it. But Kramer seconds Neil's observation. Then he goes on to say that the oil in the paints are the real clincher, one way or the other. The pigment in the paints are bound with linseed oil, and as the paint ages and starts to dry, the oil begins to evaporate, causing the surface to crack. He pauses. Then he turns to Neil. Neil asks if he can examine the painting, and Kramer encourages him to do so. Neil examines the painting, or at least pretends to, and states that the microcracks are immature, inconsistent with the level of cracking that would be present in a work that was truly over 100 years old. Kramer concurs with Neil's assessment, stating that with a little more time in the oven, it would have been good enough to even fool Kramer. Peter is frustrated at the realization that the painting is a forgery. Neil gives Peter a somewhat intense look, perhaps trying to discern any suspicion toward himself from Peter. But there is none, and Peter is genuinely thrown by the revelation.
Sorry, Peter. I know how much you wanted this.
Petey, we took down an arms dealer and recovered a number of missing paintings. This is still a win.
I thought for sure it was a real thing. The treasure was out there.
Searching for the truth is what makes you a good agent.
can't always be right. In fact, the hardest thing to do is admit you're wrong. Like I seem to be about Neil.
Do you think he's changed?
I can't say with conviction that he's reformed yet. But I can tell you, he wants to be here.
I think Neil is conflicted. Understandably, he doesn't want Peter to succeed in finding the painting and by extension the treasure, from the standpoint that if Peter succeeds, the gig is up for Neil. His consulting gig is shot at his new life, or the possibility of the new life that he sees is possible for himself. But at the same time, he does seem genuine in his condolence toward Peter. I think it's because, despite what Peter's success in this case would mean for himself, he genuinely likes Peter as a friend, and he hates to see his friend fail and be disappointed. And he's also, I think he also genuinely hates being responsible for that failure and resents having been forced into a position of having to cause his friend to fail, which also ties into Kramer's judgment that although he can't say with confidence that Neil has reformed, that he can say that Neil does want to be there. Neil's still trying to keep his feet in both worlds because he loves the thrill of the criminal lifestyle and because of his loyalty to his friends there. But he also loves his friends in the new world, and he loves his life in the new world. And he does want to be there, but he just doesn't want to quite give up what he has been and what he has in this other world in order to achieve it. He wants to have both, and he's got to figure out that he can't do that. Anyway, down in the bullpen, Neil has to face the fact that he wasn't entirely successful in his efforts to cover his tracks.
That's something interesting.
You went all out for your undercover assignment.
Tie door's a nice touch.
Maintaining cover is my specialty.
Oh, I know. Agent Jones told me how much he's enjoyed working with you all this time.
All right. You caught me. I'm not who I said I was.
No, you're Neil Caffrey, infamous con man and forger.
Guilty as charged.
How long did you think you could keep this up?
Not long. But I needed to buy some time, and it was the only play I had. Melissa, working with Peter has been one of the best things that's ever happened to me, but he started cutting me out. You know how that feels. He wasn't trusting me.
Imagine that.
I needed to know why so I could fix it. I'm sorry I brought you into this.
Obviously, I'll have to tell Kramer everything.
Of course. We'll tell him the truth. The whole truth.
If I tell him I told you about the existence of the U-boat manifest over martinis, my career's over. And you know that. It was impressive watching you work.
Likewise.
Again, another situation where, in the moment, Neil genuinely means what he's saying, without acknowledging the contradictions or even recognizing the contradictions between his words in the moment and his prior actions, between his feelings in the moment and his feelings in other moments. I needed to buy some time, and it was the only play I had. True, except that the reason he had to buy some time was because he's been trying to keep the treasure and hide the fact of the treasure from Peter, and Peter was closing in on the real Degas, and Neil had to buy time to make the switch so he could stay in this new world where he wants to stay. Contradictions. Working with Peter has been one of the best things that's ever happened to me. True, except that he's not willing to completely give up his old life and completely embrace his new life. It's only one of the best things that's ever happened to him in the moment when he's working with Peter on a case. But when he's working on a con with Mozzie, suddenly working with Peter and having to play in the new world and by the new world's rules is an inconvenient thing that's happened to him. He started cutting me out. He wasn't trusting me. Right. For all the reasons I've just stated, Neil continues to try to play both sides of the fence with the presumption that the two will never conflict and there will be no consequences in trying to play both sides of the fence. I needed to know why so I could fix it. True, except that he didn't fix it. He only applied a bandage to a gaping wound. The why is the treasure, and the fact that Neil and Mozzie have it, and rather than coming clean about it and being done with it, he was trying very hard not to come clean about it and not to be done with it. He hasn't fixed the problem, he's just pushed dealing with it, and seriously and completely dealing with it, until sometime in the future, hoping that it will never become an issue again. Again, not thinking long term, not planning long term, just trying to deal with the situation of the moment. As Melissa leaves, Peter is looking down from the upper deck, thinking, considering. Kramer comes out of the conference room, ready to head out. He stops to comment to Peter that whoever forged the painting is going to make their work a whole lot more interesting. It's the best he's ever seen. Kramer departs, leaving Peter still standing there, looking at Neil. And the light bulb that has been glowing dimly in Peter's mind a mere few moments earlier begins glowing at full intensity. He knows. He knows Neil did the forgery. He can't prove it, yet, but he knows that Neil forged that painting. At the apartment, Mozzie is with Neil, who is wanting to celebrate their success over some wine. They pulled the switch, and Neil's convinced that the FBI is off their trail. But Mozzie isn't having it. He refuses to accept the glass of wine Neil's poured for him and directs Neil's attention to the hourglass, still on the table. The sand has run out. Neil doesn't want to discuss it, asking, why can't they just enjoy their moment of victory? But Mozzie won't let it rest. He's been really patient, but it's time for Neil to choose. Leave with Mozzie and the treasure or not. Basically, are they calling it quits on their friendship and going their separate ways? But there are things about the new life that Neil's not ready to give up. Not yet. Mozzie asks Neil if he even knows what this life is anymore. He's still essentially in prison. He's on an electronic leash that prevents him from having a life of freedom as much as the walls and bars of a prison cell do. Mozzie's conclusion is that Neil has Stockholm Syndrome. Now, Stockholm Syndrome, everybody probably knows the term and has a vague idea of what it is. It's a theory that tries to explain why hostages sometimes develop a psychological bond with their captors. It's supposed to result from a rather specific set of circumstances, namely the power imbalances contained in hostage-taking, kidnapping, and abusive relationships. The theory is that emotional bonds form between captors and captives during intimate time together, despite the bonds being considered irrational by some in light of the danger or risk endured by the victims. There are four key components that characterize Stockholm Syndrome. A hostage's development of positive feelings toward their captor. No previous relationship between hostage and captor. A refusal by hostages to cooperate with police and other governmental authorities. And the hostage's belief in the humanity of the captor, ceasing to perceive them as a threat. Stockholm Syndrome has never been included in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the standard tool for diagnosis of psychiatric illness and disorders in the United States, mainly due to a lack of consistent body of academic research. The syndrome is rare. According to the FBI data, about 8% of hostage victims show evidence of Stockholm Syndrome. And because it's difficult to find a large number of people who experience Stockholm Syndrome to conduct studies on with any sort of validity or useful sample size, it's been difficult for researchers to determine trends in the development and effects of the condition. And in fact, it is a contested illness with doubts as to the legitimacy of the condition. Now, based on the criteria for Stockholm Syndrome, Mozzie is wrong about Neil being a victim on at least a couple of points. First of all, the point of no previous relationship between hostage and captor. Although they had previously no direct relationship, the pursuer-pursued relationship prior to Neil's being arrested twice does, in a sense, constitute something of a relationship. Second point is a refusal by hostages to cooperate with police and other government authorities. Mozzie's problem is that Neil is cooperating with the police and other government authorities. Not completely, as evidenced by the events of this episode, but still, for the most part, he does. And Mozzie's complaint is that Neil wants to continue doing it. A hostage's belief in the humanity of the captor, ceasing to perceive them as a threat. Well, Neil certainly perceives Peter and the FBI as a threat, inasmuch as Neil continues to operate on the wrong side of the law. And he does perceive Peter and the FBI as a threat, again, as evidenced by the events of this episode. Mozzie's problem really isn't that Neil is suffering from Stockholm Syndrome with regard to Peter and the FBI and his new life. It's that he's starting to break away from what might be called the Stockholm Syndrome of his old life with Mozzie. He's starting to break from Mozzie's somewhat Machiavellian control over him, starting to act more independently, making his own decisions based on his own best interest, or at least his belief as to what is in his best interest, and not what Mozzie says is in Neil's best interest, or in Mozzie's selfish this is in my interest, and I'm going to manipulate you into agreeing with it because I'm going to present it as being in your best interest type approach. And Neil repeats what he told Mozzie previously. I can always walk out the door, but once I do, I can never walk back in. Mozzie says, fine, that's it then. That's your choice, not mine. Then he says that he always thought theirs would be a happy ending. Neil begins quoting Orson Welles. If you want a happy ending, it depends, and Mozzie finishes this quote, it depends on where you stop the story. Mozzie turns and walks out with a final word. You're fooling yourself if you think this is who you really are. Next, we see Peter in his office. He's on the phone to Elizabeth, who's at home in the kitchen working on their dinner. He's telling her that he knows he's missing something. She tells him that he just needs to let it go for a bit. He's looked as hard as he can, and he hasn't found it. And he's probably not going to find it tonight. And if he doesn't give it a bit of a break, he's going to drive himself crazy. But Peter's concern is not just that he's missing something, but that whatever he's missing will turn up, and when it does, it's going to blow up in Neil's face. But Elizabeth counsels him not to take on the responsibility for other people's problems. Important lesson there for all of us to understand. Don't take responsibility for other people's problems. Don't assume their problems as your own. And she tells him that whatever mess Neil's made, he's made it. And if it comes out, he's going to have to be the one to clean it up, not Peter. So he should just come home, have dinner, relax with a bottle of his favorite beer, and continue working on the case because he's Peter Burke, the archaeologist. Next, we see Peter. He's outside the FBI, and it's night. The traffic on the road is passing by as he walks toward his car, which is parked on the side of the road. He opens the door, slides into the seat, and closes the door. Then he spots a cell phone sitting on the dash. The phone begins to ring, signaling an incoming call. He picks up the phone, but doesn't say anything. Voice comes over the phone. It's Keller. He begins with a few socially courteous comments, then apologizes for what he calls the theatrics, because, you know, under the circumstances, they really can't have this conversation in person. Peter naturally asks what it is that Keller wants. Keller wants Peter's help. Peter says, well, turn yourself in and then we'll see what we can do to help you. And of course, Keller says, no, that's not going to happen. But they do have mutual interest and they can help each other. He's seen the treasure. Neil has it and Keller wants it. Well, that doesn't seem to be of mutual interest and a mutual arrangement as far as Peter can see, so he asks, why should he help Keller? Keller responds, good question. How about he just goes home, relaxes with a bottle of his favorite beer, and think about it? After all, he could use some alone time. Peter's face drops, and then we see Peter arrive at home, but everything is a blur, both for Peter and on the screen as we watch. Diana, Jones, and a team of agents, including search dogs, are combing through the house. Peter only indistinctly hears the team tell him, neighbor saw a black van, Jersey plates. She was alive when they took her. We're all over the major transportation centers. He won't get out of the city without us knowing. Peter slowly walks through the house, trying to process what's happened and what is happening, but failing. He walks into the kitchen. A pot of tomato sauce has been turned over on its side, the sauce spilling across the top of the counter, down into a large puddle on the floor. A large pool of red that, in his disoriented shock and haze, could easily be seen as a pool of blood or a red veil of panic bursting in his mind. He closes his eyes, trying to close out the images, trying to process, trying to regain his calm. He hears a voice. It's Neil speaking his name. Peter opens his eyes. He turns and sees Neil. Neil's face is nearly blank. Perhaps he's in shock as well. And yet, there's a hint of concern discernible. After a moment, Peter chokes out the words, "He took my wife." A reminder that the website is at www.whitecollaredpc.com, and there you can find show notes, links to the resources I've used in creating this episode, and a link to the White Collar Fandom Facebook group. I want to thank you for listening and ask you to join me on my next episode as I share my thoughts on Season 3, Episode 11, Checkmate. Until then, take care and God bless.